Back at it for you on Connecticut Today, Monday, September 14th, as we kick off a new week. Author Richard Lyons in the 3 p.m. hour talked about his new book, The DNA of Democracy. Where has democracy come from and where is it going? Governor Ned Lamont's briefing in the 4 o'clock hour told us that he is now going to implement fines for folks who go to gatherings or hold gatherings with too many people during the coronavirus outbreak, and some folks could be fined for not wearing masks. In the 5 o'clock hour, Professor Sarah Crawford from Southern Connecticut State University updated us on the battle against COVID-19. And also, during the show, I started things off with remarks about football, the NFL season underway, my thoughts on certain things, including the Miami Dolphins taking a rather unique approach to national anthem protests, or lack thereof, for the rest of the year.
Is it authentic? That's the mystery.
Or is it just another symbolic victory?
Now there's two anthems. Do we kneel? Do we stand?
If we could just right our wrongs, we wouldn't need two songs.
We don't need another publicity parade.
So we'll just stay inside.
Until it's time to play the game.
Whatever happened to the funds that were promised? All of a sudden we got a collapsed pocket?
The bottom line should not be the net profit.
You can't open your heart when it's controlled by your wallet.
Decals and patches?
Fireworks and trumpets?
We're not puppets.
Don't publicize false budgets.
Ask the pundits, and we shouldn't have a say.
If you speak up for change, then I'll shut up and play.
If we remain silent, that would just be selfish.
Since they don't have a voice, we're speaking up for the helpless.
It's not enough to act like you care for the troops.
Millions for pregame patriotism. You get paid to salute.
Lift every voice and sing.
It's just a way to save face.
Lose the mask and stop hiding the real game face.
So if my dad was a soldier, but the cops killed my brother, do I stand for one anthem and then kneel for the other?
This attempt to unify only creates more divide.
So we'll skip this song and dance.
And as a team, we'll stay inside.
We need changed hearts, not just a response to pressure.
Enough. No more fluff and empty gestures.
We need owners with influence and pockets bigger than ours.
To call up officials.
And flex political power.
When education is not determined by where we reside.
And we have the means to purchase what the doctor prescribed.
And you fight for prison reform and innocent lives.
And you repair the communities that were tossed to the side.
And you admit you gained from it and you swallowed your pride.
And when greed is not the compass, but love is the guide.
And when the courts don't punish skin color, but punish the crime.
Until then, we'll just skip the long production and stay inside.
For centuries, we've been trying to make you aware.
Either you're in denial or just simply don't really care.
It's not a black-white thing.
Or a left-right thing.
Let's clean the whole bird.
And stop arguing about which wing.
Before the media starts wondering and guessing, they just answered all your questions. We'll just stay inside.
The bigger point I want them to make about football is that it's back and it's a good thing. Even if you are one of these people who, for some reason, I find I don't quite get it. And we all know what's going on with the... the whole national anthem thing, and I guess for week one, most if not all the teams featured what is termed as the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice, I believe the name of the song is, and of course the American National Anthem. Some teams stood up and did nothing, some teams stood up and they linked arms, some teams took a knee, some teams didn't come out, and what have I said about this from the beginning? And I'll get to my bigger point in a second, but what have I said about this in the beginning? I said, you can do all of this. You can take a knee. You can take two knees. You can lay down. You can wear T-shirts. You can spray BLM this and the names of people and everything. And it's all, if it makes you feel good, or as Sheryl Crow said a bunch of years ago, if it makes you happy, it can't be that bad. Go ahead and do it. But the bottom line is, with all these protests and all these pregame ceremonies and linking of arms and wearing of names and all this and messages on the field and messages on the helmets, it's all well and good, but in the end, it doesn't mean squat. It doesn't. And there was one team over the weekend, I don't know whether you saw this, on Thursday or Friday, the Miami Dolphins, who played, were on the road, to take on the Patriots. The Miami Dolphins said in what was kind of a two-minute video they put together on Friday, and I saw this after I got off the air, The Dolphins put this video together and they said, you know what, we're just going to stay in the room for both anthems. We're not coming out for the American National Anthem, but we're not going to come out for the Black National Anthem. We're not going to kneel. We're not going to join arms. We're not going to do this and do that, hug each other, kumbaya, get in a circle. What the Dolphin players did, about 17 or 18 of them, they put together this basic video. They just edited a bunch of them saying things like, you know, now's the time for action, this and the other. And the overall tone of it, in fact, one of the lines may have been something akin to, you know, we're tired of the public relations or tired of the PR or something like that. But I was impressed because the moment that the Dolphins did that, I said to myself, well, somebody finally gets it. Somebody in the NFL and in the realm of the woke sports person is finally saying, you know what, all this means nothing if this doesn't go beyond what we're doing. And I've said that for months and months and months. You can do all of this stuff, but if you don't get involved on a political level, on a level engaging law enforcement, on a level understanding how laws are made and passed and proposed and voted on a level where you openly talk to other groups and say, how can we fix this or move on with this, then it doesn't mean anything. So, you know, bravo and kudos to the Miami Dolphins for doing that. You can find their little video presentation. It's easy to find online. And the Dolphins basically said, we're not going to do this week because this is nothing more than hype, and it doesn't solve anything. And they're 100% right. So kudos to whomever on that team got together and said, listen, why don't we just do something a little different to tell people none of this is really going to change, if it has to change, if it will change, until we look at this from a more kind of cerebral point of view. The other thing about football is, please, I I know I have friends, family, whatever. I tend to do football discussions on the weekend on Facebook. Hey, who do you think is going to win? Are we going to win? Are we going to get killed? Would you take this point spread? And invariably, and I know there are so many people out there who seem to want to flex their arms and flex their muscles saying, I'm not going to watch football anymore this week, or I'm done with pro sports. Okay. There's no reason to keep telling people that. That's the one thing I noticed on the weekend. And maybe people feel the need to broadcast this, or people feeling the need to wave this as a flag. Understand something. When you hop on Facebook or Twitter and say, like, well, you see, I'm not watching the NFL anymore. Well, do you understand that by doing that, you've allowed the side that you disagree with to alter your activity, to alter you doing something that you enjoy? Why would you do that? No, honestly, why? Well, I disagree with the anthem. Okay, maybe I do to a point too, but what does that mean you're not going to? Nobody cares if you're not watching anymore. You think the NFL cares? They don't care. As long as fantasy stuff is around and FanDuel and DraftKings and these roto leagues, they don't care. So I don't quite understand. You think that you not watching is what? Because a certain number of players, and believe me, it's not every player. Not every player wants to take a knee. Trust me. I've covered sports. I know how locker rooms work. I've had coaches tell me on the record and off the record about how sometimes part of the locker room, or the room, as they say, has to go along with the other part just to keep the peace. So don't go crazy saying, well, see, I'm not watching the NFL anymore. So you let people who you disagree with take something away from you that you enjoy? I don't quite get that. Educated at the University of North Texas and a grad degree also at Southern Methodist University, a writer, poet, essayist, screenwriter, and author, his new book is called The DNA of Democracy. Interesting. We welcome author Richard C. Lyons to Connecticut Today. Rich, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Very good, Paul. How are you today?
I'm good. It's a gorgeous day here in the Northeast. The DNA of democracy. When I got a pitch on this, I said, absolutely, I wanted to have you on. I love studies like this, the way we are governed, not just here, but, you know, countries all around the world. And I think, Rich, a lot of people don't really understand it. When we talk about the textbook definition, Richard, of a democracy, what are we talking about?
Well, according to the Greeks, that was everybody having one vote, and that is the truest form of democracy. And it was brought to America, incidentally, in Connecticut, where on the town level and throughout yes. Massachusetts and the Northeast, everybody had a vote in how their town was managed from its beginnings. Then it developed into a federation of states later in the after the Revolution.
Mm-hmm. And we also obviously had the Fundamental Orders here of Connecticut, which is one of the earliest governing documents of the country. Richard, is there any evidence on how the Greeks came up with this? And you're right, most of us are taught in school, yeah, the Greeks gave us democracy. How did they give that to us? Do we have any idea if we go back into these Greek writings?
Yes, I go into the story in a part of the book dedicated to Athens. And what happened in Athens, and it's episodic throughout the histories that I relate. So it occurred again in Rome, it occurred in England, and again in America. There was a crucible of a tyranny and a revolt against that tyranny. In Athens, it was a tyranny of Isagoras, who hired a mercenary Spartan army to hold down the inhabitants of Athens. Mm-hmm. And out of that sprang the Athenian Constitution, wherein everybody had certain rights founded in law and above any person.
So previous to that, Richard, was governing just assumed to be the purvey of the literati, the educated, of which the peons and the serfs didn't have a say in because they weren't educated enough to govern themselves? Was that the problem?
Well, I call it the rule of the one and the few, the tyrant and his few cohorts. And so there's either an aristocracy or there is a tyrant, each of whom together or apart subjugate a people. And that is what I call the common keep of humanity. It exists in the world today, in fact.
When this idea came out of Rome and Greece and these ancient times, how did it spread, and was it pushed back against, Richard, in any points of this?
Well, yes, it was. It had a unique creation here in America, and the book goes a great deal into it because there was a meeting of the idea of the ancients coming through the Renaissance. So that was in all the universities of Europe at the same time that discoverers were discovering the Iroquois League and their belief that every individual is his own power, right? So when those two mm-hmm. when those two civilizations met on the northeast coast of America, it produced a new way of thinking called the natural man, which gave way to natural rights. And so that's how we are uniquely formed here.
The name of the book is The DNA of Democracy. The author is Richard C. Lyons. More with Richard. Hang on, Rich. We'll be back with you after we do traffic and weather together. More on the DNA of democracy coming up 3:36 on WICC. The author, the guest, Richard C. Lyons, for a few more moments. The name of the book, The DNA of Democracy. Check it out where you buy your books. I'm looking at it right now on Amazon.com. Richard, one thing about democracy I always, or democracies, or the discussion thereof, that I always find fascinating, and I feel the need to correct people on, I'm sure you've run into this too. People say, well, you know, the democracy of America, and I think this is an important distinction here. We do not live in a direct democracy. We live in a democratic republic. There are direct democracies in the world, Richard, but as you well know from your research, there are arguments pro and against that.
Yes, that's right. In the demos of Athens, it devolved into a tyranny because direct democracy is very given to passions. And so one faction of a democracy can overthrow even a majority of a democracy. So we do live in a representative republic. Though, again, at the town level, such as was first formed in Massachusetts and Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Smaller town frames of governance can be democracies. But at a larger level, when you federalize, when you become counties, states, and so forth, it demands representation, certainly at the federal level.
You've undoubtedly, Richard, heard in doing your research and looking into things like this that there are those people who are saying, well, anything based in a democracy or a democratic republic, there's a shelf life here. You know, America is well past 200 years. We did that in, 1976. And, say what you will, you lovers of America, the clock is ticking on that system. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is, and I go into this in Volume 2 of this series, which will be out in March, that all governments tend to concentrate. When governments concentrate in their authority and power, you're necessarily taking away from a democratic rule or a representative rule. And so, yes, there is a shelf life, unless you adhere to original principles, unless you believe more in the origins of the country than in power bases.
When you look at what's happening now, Richard, and strip away the personalities there, strip away, the card-carrying liberals or Joe Biden or Donald Trump on the other side, is our American Democratic Republic, the democracy of electing representatives, are we in danger of that now, do you think?
I think power has become too concentrated at the federal level and far too concentrated in the executive branch of government. And this has been something that's been developing since Woodrow Wilson. And because there is so much power in that one office over so many agencies and over the judiciary, that we are becoming very opposed camps. Neither side feels they are adequately represented, and the prize of the presidency has just grown too great.
It
used to be not so powerful.
And those who like a strong president, one who, like this president, or even presidents previously who have used executive orders, there are people who say, well, sometimes the deliberative motion of government just takes too long. It gets mired in the muck here. But the founders, Richard, basing the democracy here on what we do, change wasn't supposed to be easy. I've always been told that we shouldn't be able to just flip a switch to get things done. Do you agree with that or not?
No, I agree with that wholeheartedly, and that's why crises lend to government growth. Because everybody wants an easy fix. Everybody wants it done right away. But our form of government is legislative in nature, and that's based on debate and coming to the best compromise, which is antithetical to executive orders. Executive orders have become a habit of the executive branch, and it's not a good one.
In doing the research for the DNA of democracy, Richard Lyons, a name or two that maybe come to mind for you, for us, maybe in this discussion of people or personalities that many of us may not have learned in school or may not know offhand. Is there a name or two that people should know about?
Yes, John Locke, as he was the founder of the conception of natural rights. And then Montesquieu, who was the prophet and architect of democracy and representative government. The idea that each as individuals, we have our own power, and with that power, we delegate power to the government. We're not given power, we delegate it. That's supposed to be the right relationship. And for those two, it was revolutionary at their time.
How smart, how bright, how prescient, Richard, were the founding fathers? I mean, I read some of this stuff from Adams and Jefferson and people like, Connecticut's Roger Sherman here and all the people who signed on to the Constitution and other documents. I read some of that stuff and I don't know, to me, the brilliance of these people in trying to figure all this whole thing out really still shines through in some of the stuff you read here.
Yes, I go into that in depth in part of the work I call A New Order for the Ages, because at one time in 1787, representatives of all the colonies got together to see how they could form a new union that was unprecedented in history. So that is not an easy thing to do. But the way in which they set up our system to move like a constellation, with different powers given to different entities to balance the whole, is a remarkable miracle. And as far as we get away from that, we're ruining the miracle.
The more power we're investing in one element
as against others, we're out of balance.
I don't mean to sound like an old get-off-my-lawn kind of guy here, Richard, but I've always said openly, I'm scared that the stuff we're talking about right now and the type of books you and other people write on this, I'm scared that this stuff is not taught enough in schools and not taught early enough, maybe at not such a macro level, but, you know, I'm hearing the other day from one expert that, you know, there's only a handful of states that actually mandate studying things like this. And I think in the end, Richard, and don't get me wrong, I don't mean to be harsh when I say this, but, you know, they talk about this in computers. Well, I think this is learning, too. Garbage in, garbage out. I mean, unless people are taught this stuff, they don't really appreciate what they have.
Well, it's funny. I'd like to know what the percentages are these days, Paul, between how much Marxism is taught and how much democracy is taught in our schools. Because, again, this is another power that was taken away to the federal level a while ago, and that is the power of persons to determine how their children are educated, what they're educated in. It is no longer a matter of local rule. It's a matter of federal mandate. In being so, very few people determine what everybody's learning. And part of that has been a stealing away of our civic heritage, which is remarkable. This country is the original rebel, but now we're taught that it's uncool to believe in it.
And you say you have volume 2 of this series coming out this coming March, correct, Richard?
Yes, that's right, March 21.
All right. The first volume, folks, is out, The DNA of Democracy, Volume 1. It's available now wherever you buy your books, online, especially Amazon.com and all that. Volume 2 coming out in March. Richard C. Lyons has been the guest. Richard, thank you. Very informative.
Thank you.
Good luck, and hopefully we can chat down the line. Thanks, Rich.
Oh, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Richard C. Lyons, The DNA of Democracy. Fascinating read from what I can tell here. Reading a few of the pages here going way back. And remember, folks, we don't live in a democracy. Stop saying that. Well, a democracy of the country. No, 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 no. We live in a democratic representative republic. And to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You may say, oh, my gosh, hospitalizations up 13. So we have a total of 64 of folks hospitalized for COVID-related right now. We've averaged between 50 and 70 over the summer. So I think the numbers are still trending in the right direction. And that's what this next chart tells you. You've seen this probably 100 times. It just shows you where we had our peak back there in mid-April. We started opening May 20th. You've seen that positivity rate going down. And hospitalizations, those are the key numbers that we care about. We were up at 2,000 hospitalizations back in the middle of April. And so our weekly average is about 1.1%, up a little bit. We can talk about that, but you got to remember that's 1.1% compared to, Alabama's at 14% and Arkansas's at 21%. North Dakota with the Sturgis motorcycle rally, that's at 36%. So I think we're still in a pretty good place. Keep that chart up there. I just wanted to say, as you know, I focused a lot on the risks over the course of the next 2 months, and I thought this was going to be a really key 2 months. One was as regards getting our colleges back. We've talked about that. You've probably seen, you know, some headlines regarding what's going on at the colleges. I think it's worth remembering that we've had a grand total of 32, the infection rate at our colleges is much less than 1%. I think that's what I meant to say. Much less than 1%, really across the board. Slightly higher off campus at UConn stores. So what you see at UNC, what you see at Alabama, what you see at Notre Dame, where they had to shut down, thankfully, so far, with really strict testing, our universities have done relatively well. Western Connecticut opened up for residential students again today. I think this is really important. The Cal State system, schools, colleges in California are down. Others have been shut down. Ours, so far, are following the protocols and making a difference. And I would say the same thing for K through 12 education, where obviously there's an awful lot of attention. We have kids or grandkids who are there. I think it's worth remembering that of all the schools that have been opened, some full-time, some part-time, about a third are getting up to full-time, we've had 32 infections. That's 32 out of 600,000 or 700,000 students and teachers and administrators. So I know you see some headlines and numbers and, oh my gosh, there's an infection here, an infection there. It's a much lower positivity rate than we're used to seeing, in the general population right now. And there's some confusion, but generally that means a class is being quarantined if there happens to be an infection. Maybe there have been 10 or 12 buildings out of all of the buildings across our whole school system. So I feel pretty good about where we've gone in the last 2+ weeks of K through 12 education. Look at that compared to, we've got a third of our kids, going to school, soon to be going to school full time K through 8. We'll get that up over 50%, we hope, over the next 2 or 3 weeks as people get more comfortable. The rest are hybrid. Very, very few are just distance learning. Come on, New Haven. I think you ought to take a look. You have a very low infection rate, and these kids have a chance, ought to have an option to go to school. Obviously, nothing is mandatory. Compare that to California, which has none of their schools open. Compare that to Oregon. Compare that to New York City, which maybe is going to open up their K through 12 in the next week or two. Look at Massachusetts, which has 25% of their schools is all distance learning, no in-classroom opportunity at all. Connecticut, maybe that's 2% in those one-off situations. I think it's 500,000 of our 530,000 kids at least have the option of in-classroom education. And I think that is very positive in terms of what we're trying to accomplish. So schools and colleges, that was one of the hurdles that I saw as I thought we were sort of heading into, since it's football season, the fourth, what I hope is going to be the fourth quarter of COVID. Josh says, make no predictions, never, when it comes to COVID. We don't know what is the fourth quarter. Are we just the beginning of the first half? We're finding that out. But we do know that over the next 2 months, we're going to have a very good idea of K through 12 and college. Over the next 2 to 3 months, we're going to know how we manage through the flu season. And Deirdre has said, that's October, November. You probably heard from all of our healthcare experts. They worried about a flare-up in October, November, December. And fortunately, Connecticut is almost without peer over the last decade or so in terms of the number of people that voluntarily get the flu shot. We're going to make that free. We're going to make that readily available, do everything we can to make sure we get up to 75, 80, 85% of all of our students and folks in school with a flu shot. I think you understand that flu has the same symptoms as COVID, so there could be a rush on our hospitalization system. So school, we left up, while I really wanted schools to open, we left that up to local jurisdiction, local superintendents for reasons that, community-led. My same feeling is when it comes to football, where there's been an awful lot of energy there. And Deirdre Gifford, our healthcare team, met with CIAC, I think it was last Friday, for a couple of hours. CIAC is the Interscholastic League. They came forward with some strategies they hope would take high school football from a high-risk activity, make it a little bit safer. And I appreciate their really good faith efforts that way. Deirdre and all of our healthcare folks and also the National High School Association for Sports, all have said football is high risk. So obviously, Deirdre sent a letter to CIAC. She's health commissioner. saying, look, we strongly recommend you do this in the spring, you don't do it in the fall. That said, the final decision will be made by CIAC, probably with local input from coaches and maybe parents and superintendents, I hope, very soon. You may say, well, what's the difference? I mean, why put it off till spring? What's going to be different? I think there could be a world of difference where it's much safer. Not only are we through the risk of, the colleges, we're also through the bulk of the flu season. Hopefully, we'll have that five-minute Abbott lab test. Hopefully, we'll have some new therapies that are in the offing. I know some people are hopeful we're going to have them before Election Day. I think it's reasonable to assume we'll be in a much better position to prevent and stem and hold down COVID in February than we are in September. That said, I understand all the concerns around the vaccines. I am proud of all the pharmaceutical companies who have said, look, CDC may be operating Operation Warp Speed. We're going to be careful. We're not going to get this released until we're absolutely safe. We can get that broadly tested before it's available to the general population. With that, I just wanted to talk about some of our enforcement as we go through. Max, the next slide. This is really following the lead of our municipalities, saying that we need a little more leverage when people are breaking the rules, when institutions and businesses are breaking the rules. CCSU had a little flare-up as related to a bar. So what we said is, look, we're going to institute a series of fines for COVID-related violations, $100 for violating the mask order, $500 for organizing an event that exceeds the size limits, 25 indoors, 100 outdoors, or $250 for attending that event. That's to give our local health departments, local municipal officials, a little more leverage when they go in and talk about that. What are the size limits? Josh liked the line, if you have to count, get out. Just a little turn of phrase, just like what we had on the mask. If you have to ask, don't ask. Businesses are responsible for their own employees. Individuals are responsible for their own actions. So I think this is just one more way. We're doing this in conjunction with our other neighboring states, which makes a fair amount of sense. The final thing I wanted to talk about is our travel advisory update. Max? And this is, as you know, we've always continue to encourage, if you come from one of these high infection states, I described some of them to you before, which are very high, 15, 20 plus percent people infected, we still strongly recommend that you self-quarantine for 14 days. That is the safest recommendation. That said, some people, it's just impossible for them to do that. So we simplified the guidance by allowing you to get a negative test result, 3 days before you get on an airplane and fly up here, or it will get you tested when you get to Connecticut. You got to quarantine until we get the test results. Just gives you a little bit more flexibility. And I think you're also going to find that over the next few days, some of those bigger states that are in red that are on our quarantine list will fall off that list. So we have a little more flexibility in terms of people coming in and out of the state, although it's worth being careful. I mean, compared to, say, a few weeks ago where, maybe you had a 10% positivity and, 20 or 30 per 100,000, that's been cut in half on a nationwide basis. So the trend lines are good, and that's only good if you're careful. And you can see on that same travel advisory website the list of essential workers, those that we want to make it easier for you to get in and out of, be it military or defense or, business-related ways that we're slowly getting our state back to normal, schools, college, travel, ways that we think we can slowly build up confidence as we get back. And this next 2 months, like I said, that could be the fourth quarter of the football game. We're watching this very closely. I'd like to think by early next year we're turning the corner. Max, any questions for Paul, Josh, or myself?
Fox 61.
Good afternoon, Governor. I'm sure you've heard about this. Some people with some
semi-pro football programs on the East Coast, offering to help parents and families here in Connecticut set up a private club league for high school football players as an alternative to missing a high school season. I just wanted to get your reaction to that idea and ask if you have made up your mind yet as to whether you would do anything to block it if it started to happen.
No, like I said, education and sports, at the end of the day, that's going to be a local decision. In the case of sports, I think by the leagues. And I think that makes sense. But let me reiterate, this next 2 or 3 months is really important. And I do think that it's much safer if that season was put off till February.
And also for you, Governor, you have said you don't think the schools, especially at the grade school level, should close for just one case of COVID. What do you have to say to reassure skittish parents who are a little bit nervous about sending their kids back at all? You know, once there's a case in a school, maybe the cohort goes home for a while. What do you say to parents about that?
I say we've had a couple of weeks of pretty good activity. You see that we're erring on the side of caution. You see the principals are erring on the side of caution. And I think it's probably going to take some parents a little bit of time before they feel more comfortable with their kids getting back to school. And that's why I think you see a fair number of schools saying, let's start off on the hybrid basis, but we're planning to move to a full-time basis over the next 2 to 3 weeks if everything goes well. And if it doesn't, we know how to change course.
All right. Thank you, Governor.
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. I know we've had a little bit of a tick up in terms of the positivity rate. Do you have a better sense of what might be driving that?
Matt, I'd say we were at such a very low level. You're talking about, 30 infections here or there. Deirdre has talked about some small group gatherings where maybe you can have a flare-up. You've heard a lot about Three Rivers, the nursing home. Those type of flare-ups are risky. It's worth remembering that the infection rate across all of our other nursing homes is infinitesimal. So I'm watching this. It has been, a week. We're a little bit over 1%, but still puts us right near the bottom in terms of all our other states.
And just to clarify, I know we've seen quite a few schools, less than a dozen or so, that have closed temporarily to clean after having a COVID positive case. Are you saying that those schools, it's not necessary for them to close and completely clean?
What our team has said, I believe, is that, look, if there's a third grade class and there's an infection there, you track and trace. Make sure whoever was infected, whoever in that class, if they mingled with other people, then you've got a broader exposure problem. You've got to be careful. We're trying to keep these cohorts, obviously, as narrow as we can to those 24 kids who are left in the class or whatever that number may be. And that's how we can keep these schools open going forward. Some of them decided to close for a day just to do a deep clean after every one incident. I think this will evolve over time. I do think the principals are handling it really well.
Okay, thank you.
News 12, Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. I know you said it's CIEC's decision whether to go forward with high school football, but I guess what's your message to them? I mean, what do you think the consequences are for them and for school districts if they decide to go forward without the state's blessing?
Look, Paul spoke so eloquently the other day on football is not just football. It's being part of a team. It's having a mentor. It's what it means. It brings a lot of kids to school. I understand that. I also think at this point, I'm trying to do everything I can to eliminate unnecessary risks. And if you have a good alternative, it does seem to me that spring football, like New York, like Massachusetts, like Rhode Island, and a lot of other states, if they can make it work, I think we can make it work and keep faith with those kids.
So if they decide to move forward anyway, is there a plan in place, either at the state or local level, to protect these students, to protect coaches and anyone who might attend a game?
Well, first of all, remember, if you're a coach or you're a wide receiver and you don't feel comfortable doing this, you don't have to do it. I think you're going to find a fair number of schools reserve the right to opt out. I know a number of the You know, bigger school districts have already opted out. Anything to add on that, Paul?
I would say first and foremost, it is the responsibility of the CIAC, the administrators, superintendents, teachers, principals, and adults to make sure that the student athletes are safe, whether it's in COVID time or not. And so in this perfect example, in terms of the recommendations put forth the Department of Public Health, the one thing that I think is very important here is that the Department of Public Health is asking for CIAC to make sure that they're talking to their health professionals as it deals with any of these recommendations that they feel going forward to make football risk to be lowered. But at the very core, all of the individuals, all of the adults who play a role in the school ecosystem has a responsibility to ensure that the student athletes are safe, thus making sure the community is safe, because those student athletes are members of the larger community that they live in.
And just one last quick question. Senator Fasano today is asking you and the Democrats to add fixes to the police reform bill to the upcoming special session. Do you see that happening, and is there an update on when that session will happen?
First of all, on the police accountability bill, I think the legislature smartly said it doesn't go into effect until I think it's June 30 of next year. So there are time to make any clearly defined narrow fixes necessary to make sure it meets all protocols and laws out there. In terms of the timing, my understanding is that Paul is talking to legislative leaders. We're together going to come up with a very finite list of priorities and bills they want to have considered during the special session, and I'd like to think we can call it by the end of this week.
Dr. Sarah Crawford from Southern Connecticut State University. She is a virologist and a professor of biology at Southern. Dr. Crawford, good to speak with you again. How are you?
Very good, Paul. How are you doing these days?
I'm hanging in, Dr. Crawford, as best I can. Now, we first chatted in April, my schedule shows me, and we were kind of going into this, like, what is this thing? Then we chatted in June. We knew a little more, and now here we are in September. Where do we stand on this? Before we get into the specifics, how are we doing?
Well, we're doing probably as well as can be expected. Under the circumstances, mm-hmm. We've had quite a long haul with this virus. I was listening to your previous broadcast on 9/11, which was very moving to listen to. And I remember 9/11, of course, as we all do. And that was an event of historic consequences. And I think it's really interesting that we're talking today as well about COVID. At that time, it was a singular event, and the country came together, and despite the tragedy, we all healed. And COVID is something totally different. It's ongoing. It doesn't go away. It's hard to point the accusing finger. And there's been, as you know, a lot of, breakdown of solidarity in our country rather than coming together. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think we're doing as well as can be expected, but we're dealing with an enemy that we don't really understand, and we're developing all new methods of attack and conquer. So that is something that I think is somewhat sobering on a day like this.
So let's talk about, Dr. Crawford, the understanding. It's what you folks in biology and virology and epidemiology, try and understand. Lay people like me, we see a microscopic image and we see, well, that's kind of interesting, but some of the most brilliant minds in the world have now spent, the better part of 9 months trying to figure this out. What are some of the things, maybe some of the latest things that we have learned, Doctor, that say 6, 8, 9 months ago, we didn't know about this?
Well, I think we've learned a lot about how the virus is transmitted. I think we've learned a lot about how we can prevent transmission and what the risk factors are. I think we've learned a lot about the importance of testing. I think we have found that when we employ the appropriate social distancing measures, we have been able to bring down the incidence. And I think we're still on the quest for trying to develop an equilibrium between having a normal society and yet preventing further spread of this virus. So I think that's the cusp we're at right now. What do we do now? And I do think that the appropriate responses involve both the improved and more accessible testing modalities, as well as approaches to the vaccine. But there again, we're dealing with a fairly complicated profile, and I think one that may be, in a sense, almost a rush to judgment, thinking that the vaccine is going to be the cure-all. But I think it's going to be a much more multifaceted approach to preventing the further devastation of this virus over the next year.
Okay, I want to get into that momentarily. We have to take a break. Hang on, Dr. Sarah Crawford. We'll be right back with you. More Straight Ahead with Dr. Sarah Crawford from Southern Connecticut State University, professor of biology and a virologist, talking about what progress, if any, we are making against COVID-19. Back with more from Dr. Crawford first, traffic and weather together on WICC. And we continue right here on WICC 600. Dr. Sarah Crawford joins us, professor of biology, virologist from Southern Connecticut State University. Before the break, Dr. Crawford, you talked about trying to reach an equilibrium with this thing, which is kind of interesting. Is that so? Do you agree to some point with some of the experts that are quoted, you know, around the globe in various countries, including here in the U.S., that say, you know what, viruses don't go away? I mean, it's very difficult to, you know, eliminate that. So it's going to be a question of learning to, as you say, achieve that equilibrium and coexist with this thing?
Well, yes. The virus is here. The United States has suffered an extraordinarily high toll from the virus. It's not going to disappear. This is a new world, and the new world is one in which we're going to be more careful about human-to-human transmission of viruses, about the conditions which may cause these viruses to develop in the first place, and developing more effective preventive vaccine approaches, as well as therapeutic protocols. So I really think that this is a very eye-opening experience for the world and for the United States as far as our culture is concerned. And we're going to have to learn that this is the new normal to some degree. Now, we're not going to walk around frightened of becoming sick, but we're going to develop a culture in which when we're faced with this sort of event, which may happen again, we're going to have rapid testing. We're going to be on gear for developing vaccines and therapies. And we're going to, as a society, pay more attention to both health care and health care research, which is something that for a long time we kind of assumed wasn't that important because everybody basically lives a full life here. Mm-hmm. This is not the 1920s before antibiotics. So, you know, we're a bit complacent.
Yeah,
and which is understandable. Who expected this to happen?
No, sure. And I did read something from a gentleman, I think it was months ago at Harvard, and he kind of said something interesting. He said, look, in the future, once we get over the initial bad part about this, he said something, doctor, that you kind of just said, you know, society will go on, but when we have flare-ups of this, there's going to be a percentage of society that should be okay, just take some precautions if they are relatively healthy. Then there's going to be a portion of society that's going to have to take some, you know, better precautions, but still should be okay. And then there are going to be the people with high comorbidities, elderly, nursing homes, and they're going to be people that are just going to have to, you know, continue their lives inside, maybe for not months at a time, but just react to this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's an interesting perspective, but perhaps a somewhat limited perspective. Mm-hmm. I think there might be a tiny dose of wishful thinking in there.
Okay.
That we can compartmentalize something like this and make it the problem of one segment of society more so than, say, the average individual. And I think that's a very... I don't mean any criticism, but from my perspective, I think that's a very misguided thought. because viruses can mutate, they can change. We do know that there are comorbidities associated with susceptibility to the more severe consequences of SARS-CoV-2. Mm-hmm. However, we're also seeing a much enhanced incidence in younger individuals. So I would not be so complacent to say that, you know, we're going to take this small segment of society and we're going to say, well, if you're at risk, you're older, you're this, you're that, you know, you better be more careful. I don't think we can make that distinction. I think that is an attitude that may be somewhat cavalier and not sufficiently sensitive to the enormity of this issue if it is not addressed head on.
What do you make of what you have seen and perhaps read about the vaccine push coming out of several countries and also some of these big pharmaceutical companies? What's your opinion so far?
Well, I've been following it very closely, as you might imagine. I remember this Sputnik 5, I think, that came out of Russia that I don't know where that went. But anyway, it's somewhere in outer space right now. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, we do have some vaccines that are being developed in this country and in Europe, which have potential. I am a little bit concerned about the incidence of just one case. And I do not want to make more of this than need be. However, I do feel that it's important to take note of the fact that there is a patient, a volunteer from the AstraZeneca trial who has developed a demyelinating disorder of the central nervous system. I'm just spent the summer writing a paper on SARS-2 COVID. Mm. And it's going to be published in Medical Research Archives in a couple of weeks. But at any rate, in that paper, I go into the fact that there have been previous attempts to develop vaccines against various forms of SARS, some lesser pathogenic forms of SARS viruses, as well as SARS-CoV. And as well as related viruses such as RSV, where the virus itself may induce an abnormal immune response in a small percentage of individuals. Mm. And I think that I addressed in my paper. I hadn't seen it addressed anywhere else, and I was hoping maybe I just was focusing on one or two papers that, you know, would not have potential future significance. But at this point, I am concerned that we cannot rush to develop a vaccine that doesn't show clear safety protocol. And I'm a little bit concerned with this latest development. I think we have to be careful about a virus that, as part of its infectious cycle, induces immune system abnormalities.
Interesting.
Because there's always a potential that the vaccine itself might, in some individuals, produce a similar effect, perhaps, or upon challenge with the actual disease, cause a more severe effect. So I think we have to be very careful and very circumspect in terms of how we approach the development of this vaccine. And we cannot simply use our need or our hope to have a successful vaccine to override the clear scientific concerns that should be in play as we move forward in this direction. So I don't have a totally positive view at this point.
Okay, Dr. Crawford, hang on. One more segment with you. I want to ask you about folks who may not want to get a vaccine. We'll be back with Dr. Sarah Crawford, Southern Connecticut State University, professor of biology and a virologist. More with Dr. Crawford after traffic and weather together on WICC. Couple of more minutes with Dr. Sarah Crawford, Southern Connecticut State University, professor of biology and a virologist, as we talk about what progress we've made on COVID-19. Dr. Crawford, dovetailing off our last couple of seconds about a vaccine, I am really, well, maybe I'm not surprised. I don't know. I'm really discouraged, maybe the word is, to see all these surveys coming out with an incredible amount of people, in my mind anyway, who say, without seeing any data, without hearing how the efficacy might be, say they don't plan to get a COVID vaccine if it's available. As a health professional, as somebody who deals with this, who knows what these diseases can do, I can imagine that's got to frustrate you and the people in your business.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the problem really is a very basic one and unavoidable. Given the fact that this virus has reared its ugly head in an unprecedented way in an extraordinarily short amount of time, and people are scared. They're afraid of getting the virus. They're afraid that there's going to be a rush to produce a vaccine that really doesn't work. There's a lot of fear out there, and I appreciate that. I think that I appreciate the fact also that the a number of companies that are working on the vaccine have recently put together a public statement saying that they will not do a rush to produce a vaccine unless they're sure of its efficacy. I think that that distrust, as much as it might be disappointing, is understandable, you know, given our circumstances. This is a very frightening time to live in a sense. You know, you can, as well as I mean, you know, we can go back a year and we went wherever we went and did whatever we did. And now the whole world has changed so suddenly. And I think a lot of people are afraid that a vaccine is going to be produced that won't do the job or potentially might be dangerous, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I hope we can have enough faith in our, not only our government, but in our pharmaceutical industries worldwide, that that's not going to happen. So I think when a vaccine does come into the public forum, it will be one that at least has minimal efficacy and certainly doesn't do any harm. And I think that once that happens, I think the degree of fear will decrease. And of course, there'll always be some people who choose not to get a vaccine. And of course, there is human choice, which is acceptable. But I do think when all this plays out and we get a positive feedback, if you will, one that can be counted upon, I think people will change their mindset. I think right now there's just a lot of fear out there.
Yeah, and the final question, short of a vaccine, how are we doing? What do you hear and read from your peers regarding therapeutics? Maybe we're not at a vaccine yet, but I know with other diseases, with other bacteria, viruses, we tend to learn more about what works and what doesn't. How are we doing there?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because I didn't want to end on a negative note. I do believe that a vaccine is going to come down the pipeline that will help the situation, certainly. But I think that therapeutically, the medical community has learned so much about this virus that they're doing so much better in terms of identifying high-risk patients, about early intervention, about learning what works and what doesn't work. We've seen a dramatic decrease in mortality rates. We've seen decreases in ICU admissions. So we can see that the whole profile now is moving forward to a more aggressive therapeutic approach. So that is a very positive thing. The other very positive thing is we are developing new testing methods. In fact, I'm working with a group of individuals who's working on a biophysical method of doing rapid testing on the virus from patient saliva where you could have the results in 10 minutes. So I think, and there are many other tests in different realms, but certainly in that same venue of looking at the virus and its presence and being able to determine very rapidly whether an individual has been infected. And I think that's going to change the entire profile of this infection. It's going to help us to identify individuals who are sick, help them very early before they become critical, and also help to spread the prevent the spread of this virus in ways that are going to be very important. So I'm hoping that 2021 is going to be a much better year dealing with COVID and setting a precedent that we'll always be able to rely upon as we move forward in treating emerging viral infections.
All right, we end on a high note. Good to do that. Dr. Sarah Crawford, Southern Connecticut State University, professor of biology and a virologist, updating us on the COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic.
Dr. Thank
Crawford,
you, good, I appreciate it.
Good to
nice
talk with
to talk
you.
To you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, let's move along here. We'll wind up the hour with traffic and weather together on WICC.